It can be hard to see the challenges that people we work with every day are going through. I'm Holly Robinson-Pete. Join us on The Visibility Gap, a new podcast presented by Cigna Healthcare. Download it wherever you get your podcasts.
The countdown has begun. From May 14th to 16th, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg. Join heads of state, influential ministers, and leading CEOs to make new connections, gain unique insights, and uncover valuable opportunities in one of the world's most rapidly rising regions. Request your invite for this exclusive event at QatarEconomicForum.com.
There is no doubt we face a profound economic challenge. We now need stability and unity. I pledge that I will serve you with integrity and humility.
The most important objective for our country right now is stability. Governments cannot eliminate volatility in markets.
You're listening to Bloomberg UK Politics. I'm Ewan Potts.
And I'm Stephen Carroll. Today we're tuning in to Rishi Sunak's third Prime Minister's questions. Plenty for him to be talking about. You have to perhaps wonder whether or not there'll be questions about when Prime Ministers might start realising that maybe Gavin Williamson isn't the best appointment to Cabinet. And perhaps it was the first, the second, or maybe now the third departure from Cabinet that we've seen.
Yeah, certainly got to be odds on favourite for the first question, perhaps two questions, maybe three questions on Gavin Williamson's resignation. The first cabinet resignation for Rishi Sunak. We're about a couple of weeks into the job, and Gavin Williamson has gone. And as you say, not the first time he has resigned. A lot of resigning in a rather short career. Of course, he was chief whip, and the chief whip's known for doing some unpleasant stuff. But some of the things he's reported to have said, pretty strong stuff.
Yes, indeed. These were messages exchanged with notably Wendy Morton and also apparently with a civil servant when he was Defence Secretary, saying some really quite violent things, I think. This is what The Guardian's reporting today, that he allegedly told a civil servant to slit their throat or jump out of a window as part of when he was Defence Secretary. So, look, he has resigned. He did say in his resignation letter that he was complying with the investigatory process and has apologised to the recipient for those messages. He's now going to be facing three different sets of inquiries, two at the Independent Complaints and Grievance Scheme, which is for people who work in the Houses of Parliament or work with politicians, and another internal Conservative Party investigation as well.
Interviewed last night with Channel 4 News, spoke to Anne Milton, who is his deputy as chief whip. She said his behaviour was threatening and intimidating, and that he concocted a culture of fear to control MPs. I think back in the day, that's what whips did, wasn't it? But there is certainly a feeling in Westminster that Gavin Williamson went rather too far on this front. Look, I think these allegations are quite something, aren't they? I think he felt that it was really distracting from Rishi Sunak's premiership, and it was time to go. Interesting to listen to see who pushed who, and I think it's not quite clear on that front yet.
Yeah, as Rishi Sunak, in his response to Gavin Williamson's resignation, his response doesn't mention the allegations. He just says he supports Williamson's decision to step back and understands why he has taken it. I think a good example of these are the lines, and I hope you're reading between them.
Yes, indeed.
It'll be interesting to see what happens to the responsibilities that Gavin Williamson had. He was, of course, a minister without portfolio. He had previously been government chief whip, defence secretary and education secretary under previous prime ministers, if you can remember any of them. But this time around, he was in charge of quite a wide range of services, perhaps not seen to be keenly associated with the central operation of government, but the Government Communications Service came under his remit. Also the Geospatial Committee, which deals with handling of location data, and also the Conflict Stability and Security Fund, which it could perhaps be an interesting discussion to see who takes over that now. Yeah, and who might be best suited for it.
Yes, you could quite a random... Simon's just standing up. Let's listen to him.
About Remembrance Day, we remember all those who paid the ultimate price and all those who have served and are serving our country. Yeah. Mr. Speaker, the member for South Staffordshire told a civil servant to slit their throat. How does the Prime Minister think the victim of that bullying felt when he expressed great sadness at his resignation.
Mr. Speaker, unequivocally, the behaviour complained of was unacceptable, and it is absolutely right. It is absolutely right that the Right Honourable Gentleman has resigned. For the record, I did not know about any of the specific concerns relating to his conduct as Secretary of State or Chief Whip, which date back some years. I believe that people in public life should treat others with consideration and respect, and those are the principles that this government will stand by.
Mr. Speaker, the member for South Staffordshire spent years courting the idea he can intimidate others, blurring the lines to normalise bullying behaviour. Yeah. It's precisely why the Prime Minister gave him a job. Exactly. The truth is simple. He's a pathetic bully. But he would never get away with it if people like the Prime Minister didn't hand him power. So does he regret his decision to make him a government minister?
Mr. Speaker, I obviously regret appointing someone who has had to resign in these circumstances. But I think what the British people would like to know is that when situations like this arise, that they will be dealt with properly. And that's why it is absolutely right that he resigned, and it's why it is absolutely right that there is an investigation to look into these matters properly. I said my government would be characterised by integrity, professionalism and accountability, and it will.
Keir Starmer.
Mr. Speaker, everyone in the country knows someone like the member for South Staffordshire. Yeah. A sad middle manager getting off on intimidating those beneath him.
Yeah.
But everyone in the country also knows someone like the Prime Minister. Yeah. The boss who is so weak, so worried the bullies will turn on him, that he hides behind them. What message does he think it sends when, rather than take on the bullies, he lines up alongside them and thanks them for their loyalty?
Mr. Speaker, the message that I clearly want to send is that integrity in public life matters. And that is why it is right that the Right Honourable Member has resigned. It is why it is right that there is a rigorous process to examine these issues. But as well as focusing on this one individual, it is also right and important that we keep delivering for the whole country. And that's why this government will continue to concentrate on stabilising the economy, on strengthening the NHS, and on tackling illegal migration. Those are my priorities. Those are the priorities of the British people, and this government will deliver on them.
Mr. Speaker, the problem is he can't stand up to a run-of-the-mill bully. Yeah. So he has no chance of standing up to vested interests on behalf of working people. Take Shell. They made record profits this year, £26 billion. How much have they paid under his so-called windfall tax?
Mr. Speaker, I was Chancellor who introduced an extra tax on the oil and gas companies. But he talks about working people. The Right Honourable Member voted against legislation to stop strikes disrupting working people. He voted against legislation to stop extremist protesters disrupting working people. That's because he's not on the side of working people, Mr. Speaker. That's what the Conservatives are for.
Mr. Speaker, I'm against all of those causing chaos, damage to our public services and to our economy, whether they are gluing themselves to the road or sitting on the government benches. Mr. Speaker, there was no answer to the question because the answer is nothing. Shell haven't paid a penny in windfall tax. Why? Because for every pound they spend digging for fossil fuels, he hands them a 90p tax break, and it's costing the taxpayer billions. So will he find a backbone and end his absurd oil and gas giveaway?
Well, Mr. Speaker, what the party opposite will never understand is that it's businesses investing that create jobs in this country. Mr. Speaker, we on this side of the House, we understand that. We will support businesses to invest, to create jobs, because that's how we create prosperity, that's how we support strong public services, and that's what you get with a Conservative government.
There's only one party that crashed the economy, and they're all sitting there. It's a pattern. Mr. Speaker, it's a pattern with this Prime Minister. Too weak to sack the security threat sat around the Cabinet table. Too weak to take part in a leadership contest after he lost the first one. Too weak to stand up for working people. He spent weeks flirting with the climate change deniers in his party, then scuttled off to COP at the last minute. In the budget next week, he'll be too weak to end his oil and gas giveaway, scrap the non-dom tax breaks, and end the farce of taxpayers subsidising private schools. That's what Labour would do, a proper plan for working people. Yes. Mr. Speaker, if he can't even stand up to a cartoon bully with a pet spider, if he's too scared to face the public in an election, what chance has he got of running the country?
We want, we want to try and get through on time, and I know some members want to catch my eye. They're not doing a good job so far. Come on, Prime Minister.
Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman talks about judgment about putting people around the Cabinet table. I would just gently remind him he thought the member for Islington North was the right person to look after our security. But, Mr. Speaker, the Honourable Gentleman, he said a lot today. He said a lot today, but it's clear that he isn't focused on the serious issues that are confronting our country. We're strengthening our economy. He's backing the strikers. We're supporting people with energy bills. He's supporting the protesters. And we're tackling illegal migration. He's opposing every measure. The British people want real leadership on the serious global challenges we face, and that's what they'll get from this government.
Keir Starmer sitting down after 12 minutes of Prime Minister's questions, going three questions on Gavin Williamson and three on the budget speculation, and primarily on the windfall tax. Stephen, I thought Keir Starmer was in pretty good shape here. Some of his questions perhaps a little bit verbose, but plenty of support from behind him. And I thought some of his attacks were quite strong, weren't they?
Well, I was admiring his pivot that he made from talking about Gavin Williamson, describing him as a bully and saying, well, if you're not going to stand up to bullies like him, how will you stand up to vested interests, and pivoting quite neatly to the call for the windfall tax to be changed, because in his, as he described there, that companies like Shell that earn massive profits are getting big tax rebates as they're, if they're reinvesting those profits in digging for more fossil fuels. So it was an interesting sort of juncture to move from one to the other. You know, Rishi Sunak did engage with the premise over Gavin Williamson, saying he did regret appointing someone who had to resign in these circumstances, and what British people wanted was to see this dealt with properly, and right that there was an investigation, and right that he had resigned. So I don't think there's any love lost. The Gavin Williamson has gone from the Cabinet by the sounds of things, but the conversation moving on quite quickly as well.
Yeah, saying that everybody knows someone like Gavin Williamson, a sad middle manager, a sad bullying middle manager. And Starmer trying to say that Sunak was too weak to take on the bully that is Gavin Williamson. But Sunak saying that he obviously did regret making the appointment. But as you say, yeah, that interesting pivot onto some budget speculation, particularly on the windfall tax. You have to say that increasing the windfall tax has got to be a hot favourite for the autumn statement on the 17th. But yeah, Starmer thinking he's got plenty to go there, saying that Shell managed to pay absolutely nothing in the windfall tax after those enormous profits recently.
Also laying out, I suppose, his three key points that will give us an idea of where the attack points will will be for the autumn statement next week, talking about one of them being the windfall tax, the other one scrapping the non-dom status, and also scrapping public subsidies to private schools. That gives us a bit of an insight into how Keir Starmer will be planning to counter some of the announcements that are going to be made next Thursday by the Chancellor in his autumn statement. Of course, there's been plenty of reporting and speculation on what that might contain. Interesting to get the point of view, as we did, from Simon French from Panmure Gordon, who says that these sort of speculation can actually be quite bad for the economy, that he Simon French arguing that the leaks that we've been getting in advance haven't been terribly helpful. So that was the third Prime Minister's questions by Rishi Sunak, dominated, as we heard, by conversations over Gavin Williamson after he resigned from the Cabinet yesterday.
Yeah, Stephen, I was just remembering Budget Purdah. Now, I don't know if you remember this from the 1990s, but it was absolutely forbidden for civil servants or for ministers to discuss anything which might possibly be in the budget. And
well, of course, they're not officially doing that this time either.
Well, I mean, it's not just that that's kind of gone away, but it's almost like it's obligatory for all media outlets to question ministers about everything that's given in the budget, and for ministers to comment or not comment. The whole thing has become a complete sort of circus. But yes, as you say, not officially, but certainly leaks are plenty, and plenty of speculation, and a lot of it, of course, will not come to pass on the 17th of November.
Yeah, and we are keeping an eye on Prime Minister's questions as it continues. The SNP's Ian Blackford up there asking his question now at the moment.
The countdown has begun. This May, 1,000 global leaders will gather in Doha for the Qatar Economic Forum powered by Bloomberg, held in conjunction with our official partners, the Qatar Ministry of Commerce and Industry and Media City Qatar, and premier sponsor QNB. Join heads of state, influential ministers and leading CEOs to make new connections and gain unique insights. Learn more at QatarEconomicForum.com.
I'm Alex Rodriguez.
And I'm Jason Kelly.
From Bloomberg, this is The Deal. Each week, you'll hear us in conversation with business icons.
This show will explore deal-making across sports, media, and entertainment.
That is a harsh lesson in business.
Sports is not as simple as bringing a bunch of big names together.
I didn't want to do another stomp you out speech.
It opened up so many more doors.
The show is called The Deal.
Listen to The Deal wherever you get your podcasts.
And watch on Bloomberg Originals, Bloomberg Television, or BTV Plus.
But I want to turn to another story that we've been covering for you here on Bloomberg, and this is to do with perhaps something you might have missed, but there has been progress on the UK and European Union negotiations. They're close to a major breakthrough on Brexit, and we've got our political reporter Ellen Milligan with us now, who broke this story. She's in Brussels covering this. Ellen, talk us through the scoop that you have. Some progress, finally. What's changed?
So the EU for a long time has been asking for access to live trade data that the UK holds on goods passing from Great Britain to Northern Ireland. It was actually a requirement under the protocol that the UK has to provide this information. And for the first time this week, the EU has begun testing this database. So for the next few weeks, it's going to see whether it's satisfied with the amount of information they're given. And if it is, that's going to really enable them to unlock the key to an agreement on customs, which is one of the big kind of gripes between the two in terms of reaching a wider deal on the protocol.
So the UK wanted what it calls green lanes to be approved. Where does this leave the chances of that becoming a success?
So the UK calls it a green lane and the EU calls it an express lane, and they're probably going to make some kind of agreement halfway between the two. The UK basically wants no checks on goods which go from Great Britain to Northern Ireland and vice versa, which just stay within the UK internal market and don't travel to Ireland or the EU single market, whereas the EU says that there needs to be some checks, but they can be minimised if there's an agreement reached on customs. So having this data in place so the EU can carry out proper risk assessments on the goods travelling into their market will really help progress in an agreement on that.
This is the principle of trust and verify. The EU wants to, you know, they want to establish a relationship between the EU and the UK where they trust each other on who's travelling, but also having the chance to actually check when they want to.
Yeah, exactly. This is all about trust. Trust that the UK is implementing the system properly, trust that it's giving enough information, and trust so that they talk about the integrity of the single market a lot, and they need to rely on having all the details of the goods travelling in there. And I think if they determine that the system works properly, and if they don't, if tweaks are made swiftly, I think that will go some way in terms of the trusting relationship.
And just while you're on the line, just been watching, keeping an eye on Prime Minister's questions, and our interview with Trade Secretary Kemi Badenoch has just been referenced by Applied Cymru MP asking about the government. Kemi Badenoch told Lizzie Verdon that pretty much every previous OBR forecast has never been quite right. Made a lot of headlines that, and it's just been raised at Prime Minister's questions.
Okay, and that's a story I know that, Ellen, you worked on as well. But I want to continue on some of the issues around the implications of this story that you've been reporting on to do with Brexit. This sharing of data is seen, as you say, as a very necessary step, but it doesn't resolve perhaps some of the bigger issues that still are outstanding. Is there any sign of movement on the other things that are being talked about?
Yeah, speaking to officials on both the UK and the EU side, an agreement on customs is one of the kind of most achievable things within the wider framework of fixing the issues around the protocol. There's some real fundamental disagreements that remain about the governance and the role of the European Court of Justice in Northern Ireland, about taxation and about, for example, sanitary checks on goods passing between Northern Ireland and Great Britain. Those involve human checks on live goods, for example. So these issues still remain. And so I would say the overall mood is cautious optimism at the moment.
And Ellen, what's the latest on the election at Stormont? You know, we were supposed to get that next month, but that's not going to happen now. There's going to be a statement, isn't there, later in the House?
Yeah, we'll be hearing from the Northern Ireland Secretary, Chris Heaton-Harris, very soon. He's expected to extend the deadline for when the executive in Northern Ireland can be formed until the early part of next year. That means they're trying to prevent an election, but even if an election is called, it will be called at a later date rather than next month. It gives them space and time to reach an agreement on the protocol, which hopefully would persuade the Democratic Unionist Party to take its seats. But what they're trying to do is avoid getting too close to the 25th anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement, which is in April. They really want the power-sharing government to be formed and sitting by then, understandably.
Is there going to be celebrations in Northern Ireland that this data-sharing situation looks like it's coming to a conclusion? Will it go some of the way to addressing the DUP's concerns?
This is more about the EU's concerns rather than the DUP's concerns when it comes to data sharing. I would say it's too early to have celebrations. If there is a customs agreement that comes out of this, and it will take some weeks for the EU to even see whether they're happy with this database yet, then that will really help the trade disruption that's been caused. One of the big arguments of the DUP and the UK government is that this has caused a big trade disruption within the UK's own market. So it will help some of that, but the DUP is still very much concerned, for example, about the governance, the ECJ's role, and how that treats Northern Ireland differently to the rest of the United Kingdom. And those kinds of issues aren't resolved by this data sharing.
No, indeed, and that's a much bigger conversation and something that could be a much longer battle to try and get the EU and the UK to come to an agreement on that as well. In terms of kind of the broader situation in Northern Ireland, this bringing this data sharing deal to closer to conclusion, as you've been reporting, it's given the turmoil that there's been, particularly in London, if you think about it, over the past couple of months, how has the progress been able to be made while we've had so many changes of governments, frankly, since the summer?
Well, actually, talks restarted under Liz Truss after an 8-month stalemate, which was quite a surprise, I think, because her rhetoric was particularly strong on Brexit over her summer leadership campaign. There's been a much warmer relationship. The mood music has changed. You saw Rishi Sunak and Macron's body language at COP a couple of days ago, and how they might be close to a deal on Channel crossings, for example. So everyone here talks about the mood music has improved, but that doesn't mean that anything of substance has necessarily changed. One thing that the EU is still saying that they don't quite know what the UK's position is on certain things. Sunak and Foreign Secretary James Cleverly hasn't really set that out yet in the negotiations. What they're doing week by week is they're taking each issue within the protocol, so whether it's customs or taxation, each separately, and they're yet to find out, for example, what the UK's firm position is on the ECJ, for example. So that's something that's to be determined.
So this isn't necessarily an indication of how Rishi Sunak's government plans to do business with the EU. This is something that really has been worked on for quite a while.
Yeah, it has been worked on for quite a while. And part of that actually is the relationship between the UK government and the Irish government. Simon Coveney yesterday, the foreign minister in Ireland, said that he actually thinks a deal is doable by the end of the year. Obviously, that would mean concessions from both sides, particularly from the UK. Might be a bit overly optimistic to say by the end of the year, but you're kind of seeing the rhetoric change and become a lot more positive.
Yeah, it was interesting to hear Micheál Martin, the Irish Prime Minister Taoiseach, was speaking to our colleagues at the COP27 Climate Summit yesterday, and he was saying that they do have another meeting planned with himself and Rishi Sunak. And of course, that part of the relationship is so important as well, and not only the broader context of trying to resolve the issues in Northern Ireland, but also keeping that key relationship warm, I should say, while the bigger issues are being sorted out between London and Brussels as well. So the next step we should be expecting is from the Northern Ireland Secretary, Chris Heaton-Harris. He's due to speak in Parliament shortly, and that's when we should hear what exactly is planned to happen in terms of that election to Stormont. Interesting to hear what he will have to say. The deadline had been, the legal deadline, set for January. Do we have an indication of how far that might be pushed back, Ellen?
I think the legislation will give them space to move it further back than maybe the initial delay. What we're told is that they're looking at an election end of February if Stormont isn't up and running by then. It gives them enough space from the end of February to the 10th of April, when the anniversary of the Good Friday Agreement is, to persuade Stormont to get up and running again, to have reached a deal on the protocol, while also being able to celebrate that anniversary, which will become harder if the executive's not up and running. But I think there's going to be an option in the legislation that if there's no resolution by then, it could be extended further.
Okay, Ellen Milligan in Brussels, thank you very much for your reporting on that. Interesting to watch what Chris Heaton-Harris will tell Parliament later as well. Also watch out for what he might say about the salaries being paid to members of the Northern Irish Assembly. Cutting their salaries is one of the powers that Chris Heaton-Harris has. They currently get a basic salary of £51,000. It'll be interesting to see if there's an announcement made on how that might be cut as well.
Bloomberg UK Politics. Listen weekdays at noon on DAB Digital Radio in London.
Join Bloomberg in San Francisco or virtually on May 7th for The Future Investor, Data-Powered Transformations. This 2024 event series will examine how data is not only playing a pivotal role in investment decisions, but serves as a driving force behind the construction of innovative, investable enterprises. This series is proudly sponsored by Invesco QQQ. Register at BloombergLive.com/futureinvestor/radio.